Well, good evening. Welcome to this live stream on the 25th of September 2025. Yes, it's Thursday, not my normal day, but important conversation nonetheless. That's Martin North here from Digital Finance Analytics. Thanks for taking some of your time out this Thursday evening. And we're going to have an interesting conversation in a moment or two with Chris Bates about the first time buyer story. And just to set the context, story is, of course, 25th today. I actually, of course, ran a show on Tuesday with Edwin. We did a live rant and we spoke about the first time buyer situation there. And Edwin was focusing on two things, the sort of emotional side of buying property, particularly now, and also the spousal pressure, which I thought was quite interesting. And next Tuesday, we're going to have a further discussion around this first-time buyer situation with B-Writer. Aaron's coming on, so that's next Tuesday, and he actually posted this rather interesting teaser. He's going to be wearing a Christmas sweater and snorkel next Tuesday. Why? You'll have to tune in to find out. So I don't know why he's wearing it, but I'm sure he'll find out. Should be fun. And just before I bring Chris in, let me also remind you that we don't provide specific financial or property advice. It's general conversation. We moderate the chat, but feel free to throw your questions and comments in as we go. And if you use that What the Word, that'll get my attention. And also, I've enabled Super Chat, which means you can get your question to the top of the list, or indeed make contributions. What we're doing here, always greatly appreciated. Right, let me bring Chris straight in. Chris, welcome, welcome. Thank you very much for coming out on a Thursday evening.
Hi, Martin. Nice snorkel. A Christmas jumper, just in my pajamas after I got my 3 and 5 year olds to sleep. Probably using, what's it called? Toothpicks to keep my eyes open. Thanks for moving it to a Thursday as well, not a Tuesday. I play football in six-a-side in summer on a Tuesday night, and it's just like amazing. And so apologies, and I appreciate you moving this to a Thursday, but that football in the summer is too hard to miss. So thanks for moving it.
Yeah, that's good. And sorry, I pushed the wrong button. So just to confuse everybody. So there you go. That's Chris Bates at Alcove, your latest incarnation.
Oh, yes. The story.
Very good. And it's interesting because you actually sent out a note to your list the other day relating specifically to this first-time buyer change, which is coming in, right? So the government's new scheme. And I'm quite concerned about some of the implications of it. Now, maybe I'm wrong. Maybe it's, a good thing. But just a few sort of stats to get us going. This is actually the trend of first-time buyers' loans per quarter. This is from the ABS. They need to publish this data quarterly now, right? And you can see that there was a significant run-up in 2009. That was when interest rates obviously were, lower. But there were a lot of government-backed incentives. And then we had another spike in 2021. That was post-COVID. And so the volume went up. And it's been tickling around the 30,000 a quarter, right? That's the first sort of way of looking at it. The second way of looking at it is this one. This is actually the total value of new first-time buyer loans per quarter, so the dollar value. And you can see that it's been rising significantly recently. There was a peak, obviously, earlier. But this is the killer one, Chris. This is the average value of the new first-time buyer loan. And you can see it's been climbing. Well, it's been climbing forever, really, from 2002. But $550,000 is now the average new first-time buyer loan. And I'm thinking, gee, that's a lot. That's a lot when you think about where normal incomes are. And so I guess my question is, are we in a situation where this extra incentive from the government is going to create issues? Or is it just normal course of business? And you do a lot of conversations with first-time buyers. What's your initial take on what's going to play out here? Because I'm a little bit concerned that people might get in over their heads.
Well, Martin, I've been coming on here for a long, long time. Yes, there's always potentially people who are going to take out debt that, they get excited by a 5% deposit scheme and, go into a lot of debt. But yes, there's potentially people who, will over leverage and they shouldn't have bought, but and there'll be ones that are bought by poor assets. They'll rush it, they'll buy something without doing a building and pest inspection. So absolutely there's going to be, but I do think What you will find, though, is that a lot of first-time buyers will take advantage of it, and that will create a bit of momentum in the market, particularly because there are restrictions in terms of caps in capital cities. I mean, they've gone up a lot, and I mean that's why this policy is such a big shift from 1 October. I mean, I started to pen that article. Actually, I was overseas at the time, and I was like, it's just. I'm surprised we're not seeing more and more articles about this 5% deposit scheme coming in January. It's sort of been forgotten about. There was nothing going on in the media. And I thought, no one's probably catching on that in January, this is going to be a pretty big shift in terms of the number of first home buyers that are going to be eligible who are going to want to take advantage of it. Not just because of they can now are eligible because of the income caps, but because the city caps are up dramatically and it's moved from oh, look, I can just get a place that may suit me and give me a longer, a shorter runway to actually, if we be careful here, we could probably get something that we could really live in long term, particularly if you're a couple and you're planning a family. And so, I mean, alongside that graph, I mean, you did three graphs there. Probably the other graph you probably should be, adding in there is, once the average age of the first home buyer buys, I mean, it's sort of mid-30s now. It's not, 20-year-olds buying that are going into 500 grand debt. I mean, that's just not the case. And so I think that's something to do with it. I mean, the rises of those loans probably isn't to do is the same rate as the property market as well. So yeah, I don't know. I mean, I think you may find there's and in the fringes, that you'll find some people that have over-leveraged that haven't thought it through. But once they've got ownership and once they've got the mortgage, they're going to do everything they can to keep it. And so people learn pretty quickly that you've got to pay a mortgage every month and, you've got to stay on it and you could lose the keys. And if they have to put in 5% deposit, they're not going to want to lose that. So, yeah, I don't know. I sort of back the generation that they're actually going to do this. I mean, and even if they do buy and they have issues, that's going to be at an individual basis. It's not going to create a big market. Sell off where arrears are going to be enormous, and you're going to see all these first home buyers that have stuffed it up. And even if they did that, there'd be enough first home buyers re-entering wanting to buy. So I don't know. I think it's the biggest issue here is that what you're doing is you're basically bringing forward future demand to today. It's like a credit card, right? So you're basically saying, look, you don't need to wait 3 or 4 more years where you thought you might have to save a 10, 15% deposit. You can do it right now with 5%, and particularly if you don't have to pay stamp duty. And if you do have to pay stamp duty, maybe it's up to say 10% of the purchase price, which is a big shift. Particularly if you're say a first home buyer who might have 30, 40,000, and you might think, oh, actually, I thought it was too far away, and now I'm doing the numbers. I've spoken to someone. Oh God, I actually could do it in the next few months, and then you rattle the tin around family and you look what other things you can sell and all of a sudden you can make it happen. And so that's the other thing as well. I mean, it's goal gradient theory, right? So if you feel you're closer to a goal, you're more likely to pick up the pace and get there faster. And so, yeah, I mean, I don't know. Is it a bad thing that 30, 40,000 first home buyers enter the market every quarter? I don't know. I think it's, you've got to look at some of the biggest issues that people when they're in the 50s, 60s, maybe not your age, Martin. Happy birthday, by the way. But there is, massive issues with homelessness, the biggest, issues with, singles and widows who, are renting and the older generation. So, first home buyers trying to get an asset for their future, is that a bad thing that that number is has been going up?
Yeah, and I'm not wanting to stop people going and buying property, but I want to make sure that they enter the property market with their eyes open. And the risk is, of course, that people will think, oh, whoopee, all boots in and not do the work, as it were. Just in terms of the guarantee, let's just go through. So, from October the 1st, as you say, as little as 5% deposit, right? And they've removed some of the income limits and property price caps to make it more available for more first home buyers. And of course, the other point, the government provides a taxpayer-backed guarantee for up to 15% of the value of a home loan that eliminates the need for lender's mortgage insurance. I think that's probably one of the most significant factors as well, because of course, lender's mortgage insurance was significant in terms of the extra costs that people were actually having to pony up because the banks would insist on it. So combined, I think that's going to create significant extra demand. And what I'm wanting to ensure is that we don't, as a result of that, see two factors that could play out. One is we might see a rise in property prices in this sector of the market. I think we probably will. All the evidence is that when the incentives come in, prices rise to sort of meet that extra cash that's available. Saw it in Western Australia through the home builder scheme, and we've seen it elsewhere. And the other point, of course, the Productivity Commission research on this incentive program, and they looked at various types of programs, made the point that what you tended to do was to facilitate those who were already close to getting into the market to get into the market, but didn't necessarily tackle the true unaffordable nature of housing for many people, the first point. And the second one, that really it was more about providing value to the sellers rather than the buyers, because of course prices tend to rise, right? So there were some of their observations, and basically what they said to government was, every time you put these extra incentives in place, you give property prices a kick up, but of course that makes it harder in the longer term for other people to climb in. Now, I want to take also your other point is dead right. So the average age at which a first-time buyer is now buying is 10 years later than it used to be. And that's a very big factor. So they're likely to be more down the journey of their income growth. And of course, incomes have been somewhat flat. They also tend now to have two full incomes that they put in.
Yeah.
And that, I think that one and the bit compared with two is one of the other big factors that I see that really makes a significant difference. And so when you actually think about it, they're probably more able to reach out and reach up, and therefore the government's leg up can help. And just in terms of eligibility, it's worth highlighting that you've got to be a citizen, Australian citizen or permanent resident, at least 18 years. You must be a first home buyer or have not owned a property in Australia in the past 10 years. And you must live in the purchased home, at least initially. And as I understand it, applications will go through participating lenders, including the majors like NAB, Commonwealth and Westpac. But presumably a lot of people will come for our mortgage broker to get the best advice. So what are the sorts of things that you would want to home in on in this sort of conversation with a prospective first-time buyer thinking about getting onto the scheme?
But I mean, you're dead right. I mean, the reality is it doesn't solve housing affordability. It just, you know, kicks the can down the road. But, you know, I do think the governments around the country are probably switching on that, you know, the supply equation also has to shift. We can't just be, you know, focused on releasing house and land packages on the, you know, the greenfield sites of our capital cities. We can't just be putting high density apartments in certain postcodes and not really focusing on trying to create communities that families want to live in and an alternative to houses. And potentially we just maybe even cutting up blocks in the middle and outer fringes to build, you know, townhouses and duplexes. You know, those three solutions in themselves aren't enough. They have to start to come up with some more options, whether it's build to rent, whether it's, you know, fighting back against the NIMBYs and, you know, creating zoning changes in our capital cities. You know, there's a lot that the state governments are sort of doing. And I think that they're finally taking that serious, I would say. And, you know, Chris Minns in New South Wales, you know, he might be unpopular in lots of parts of Sydney just because he has sort of stood up to the NIMBYs, you would say. And a lot of people say, oh, you know, the developers aren't going to build because it's too expensive to build. And, you know, it's only going to make, they're only going to be able to build in areas where they can get feasibility, which is true, right? Developers aren't a charity. They're going to build where they can only make a profit. But if you change zonings in areas and more affluent parts of, say, Sydney, which they've done, those feasibilities, if you combine houses together and you start to build, you know, apartments, and particularly if you can build apartments that suit downsizers, I think you absolutely will find that you can sell them. And that while people think, oh, you know, if you're just building houses for the downsizers, it's not really going to help the first home buyers. Well, ultimately there is a bit of a, you know, if they move out of a house, then the person who might be in the apartment might be able to upgrade into the house and the house comes available for a first home buyer, etc. So you do need to shift the housing market and create supply, I think, on all levels, not just from the affordability segment to etc. So yeah, I mean the big concern with this 5% deposit scheme is, I mean, we've had investors already trying to who are a little bit switched on than most, to be honest, buying, you know, in the middle of this year post-election in Melbourne and in Sydney and buying well under those price caps, maybe buying houses around 700,000 in Melbourne and buying apartments in the low 1 millions in Sydney, knowing that A, other investors are going to try to do this, and two, first-time buyers are going to want to go to these postcodes and these pockets in particular, because they tick a lot of boxes for first-time buyers, and their budget, forces them to certain pockets. There's no point looking at houses at 1.5 million because that's where first-time buyers can't get the cap. But houses under $1 million in Melbourne or 1.5 in Sydney, or good apartments under 1.5 are where a lot of first-time buyers are going to go. The big concern is that while you can increase demand very quickly, we've even just bringing it forward 3 months, you wouldn't think that the demand would be able to move that fast. But our applications over the last 2 months, have been enormous for first-time buyers, because ultimately, there's a lot of noise around it. You got to think there's 20,000 mortgage brokers out there right now. They've all got databases, they've all got client, they've all got, 90% of first-time buyers go through mortgage brokers. So, first-time buyers have got a high level of trust with just going directly to brokers, not banks. And so if they're in the database of mortgage brokers, they're going to be most likely getting advertised to, and they're getting made aware of. And then you've got friends and, going to work colleagues, and then there'll be the media jumping in on it as well to sort of talk about, the short term, the growth, I guess, you'll find in these first-time buyer markets. And so the problem is, when you've got this market that can, more demand can enter quite fast due to a date, it's like next week's gonna be a very busy week for us as a business, because we have to lodge everything in that first week. And that in itself is gonna create a few issues, because banks are gonna get busy, turnaround times for pre-approvals, and you've got to be really careful around when you sign the contract and when you get the bank pre-approval. Just be really careful, you know what you're doing there, and have a good broker. But once people do get pre-approved, the issue is they're going to go into the market, and they're focused so much on the loan. Now all of a sudden they've got to get their head around, what am I doing with it? I've actually got to get a good asset. And I think this is the thing, when you said what's concerning, I would say this is it. I think first-time buyers are the ones who've got the most to really lose. It's really the opportunity cost, if they get it right or wrong. If they get it right and they end up getting a good asset, and then they live there for 3, 5, 6, 7, 10 years, a lot of first-time buyers, it's not their forever home, right? And if they get it right and they do well, then obviously they get a return for that, right? But if they don't, and they maybe buy something with building issues, or they buy a really poor apartment in the block, or there's lots of properties that underperform. You only have to look at the Catality Pain and Gain report to understand that. Then yeah, they had an opportunity, but they didn't get it, and potentially they've got into a mortgage. Maybe that mortgage, after even on 5, 6% interest rates, is more expensive than renting, and then they had paid strata costs, and maybe there was a special levy. And yeah, they own a home, but have they actually got ahead over that period? And I think that's where first-time buyers really need to take it quite serious right now and go, right, okay, I can buy, but now I need to be smart. And also, the other thing I think we'll find is, if the first-time buyer takes their time, there's certain periods in markets where opportunity costs can be quite large, because markets can move quite quick. So every first-time buyer's got a tight budget. Borrowing capacity, yes, it's gone up over the last this year with 3 rate cuts. Some changes with HECs that are a bit controversial. The APRA hasn't stepped in yet. There might be another 1 or 2 cuts in the next 6 months or something. So borrowing capacity's gone up, but it's not anywhere near like it was. And so, a lot of first-time buyers, and that brings support to our banking system. We're not leveraging people at 10 times income. It's more like 5 times income. And first-time buyers usually have a stronger trajectory of income than, say, other parts of the market. And so I guess, yeah, I mean, that's going to limit first-time buyers on where they can buy. And I think if you're buying at your budget, let's say your budget, because your deposit, say, 900, right? And you go, oh, go and buy in the suburb, because I saw a property selling for 900 last month. And then that property goes to 960. Okay, well, you pushed out. And then you go to the next suburb, and you go there, oh, I can buy in this suburb for 900 because there was one that sold there. And so what can happen is, you can very quickly start chasing your tail, and you basically are following the market and keep missing out, because you can't find many properties anyway. And basically, from all, Mid-November time, listings will naturally dry up. It's just agents are getting tired. No one wants to have a property on the market over Christmas. We may see a little bit more just if there's really strong demand. You know, some investors might want to bail on their assets to first-time buyers or something. But I do think it's usually going to be quite dire in December and January. The agents just sort of have a break. And so really talking like a month to 6 weeks tops of listings. And so you could very easily miss out once or twice. Then all of a sudden you enter the market again in February. And February is always a bit of a time where January a lot of new buyers usually enter. It's just, you know, new year, new me, let's make this happen, you know. And we're quite busy in January usually. It's usually a month where a lot of buyers are getting ready. So I know it's a long answer, Martin, but you know, yes, loans important and yes, getting the right, you know, we can figure that stuff out. But the key thing is making sure you get an asset that actually works for you, and really think that through, and then have a strategy on how you're going to go and make that happen in a reasonable time frame, not a needle in the haystack strategy.
Yeah, and no, I think that you've covered there in you know a very nice round way all of the critical issues that people. It isn't just the mortgage, is it? It isn't just getting the money. It is actually about making sure that you buy sensibly, and sensibly isn't just you know price. It's actually about location, facilities, all those things. And then the other factor that I think is really important, I find this in my one-to-one conversations, is over what time frame are you thinking of living in this place? And quite often people seem to me to have very short windows in their mind. You know, I'll hold it for a couple of years and then move on. But when you think of the entry costs, even with you know all of the bits and pieces that you'll get now from the government to help, the entry costs are still quite significant. And you really need to be thinking of not a 2 year, but I think closer to a 5 or a 7 year window as more likely to be the sort of the time frame within which you should be thinking about the plans that you want to make. And then that means that you need to be a little bit careful about what types of property do you actually go after. It isn't just price, you see, but what I feel is that particularly first-time buyers at the moment is they're being confronted with this deadline, you know, 1 October, panic, 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 got to move. You know, you get all the stuff in the newspaper saying, yeah, it's going to put prices up. And then you think, well, panic, panic, ought to buy anything. And unfortunately, unfortunately, I do have war stories of first-time buyers who got bounced. And in retrospect, they've realized they've made a massive, massively bad decision. But it's really quite difficult to unwind. And it can be costly. So, you know, you've got this sort of conflicting set of forces, imperatives to do stuff, but also make sure you actually don't just miss the really important steps in the process. And for me, that's the real message, I think, from this show is there's still a lot of work to be done. There's still a lot of careful steps to be thought through, even if you do them relatively quickly to try and actually get into this sequence, which, as you say, is going to be a month, 6 weeks before Christmas, and then in February. The other issue, the banks and their underwriting processes, are they different for those under the schemes relative to normal? Does it take longer? Do they charge different interest rates or not? I mean, how does that all work, Chris?
Let me just double down on your point there, because I think it's a really good one around the time frame. And you know, it makes a lot of sense. If you're getting a 95% loan, yes, your leverage benefit is actually a lot higher, by the way. Like it, you know, you're really only putting in 5 and you're getting, you know, a property worth, you know, 20 times that amount. But that can work for you and it can also work against you, right? If you see a 5% decline, you basically wiped out all your money. And you can get stuck in the property. You could be losing money if you know, you have to pay agents and there might be a special sinking fund. And so yeah, there absolutely you've got to be super careful. I think the first time buyers you got burnt the hardest, like a lot of people who entered into the housing market have probably done okay, first home buyers. You know, just the reality of the cost to build and, you know, buying land in, say, and even region locations, first home buyers, if they went there, like they've probably done all right over the last 5 years. The ones that really did get burned are the ones who got caught up in the 2012 to 2017 high rise build. Basically boom, right? And, you know, there was a lot of poor quality, high density apartments were getting built. A lot of them were getting sold to investors and they basically flooded the market. They were getting built. You know, land was cheap, building costs was cheap. The desire, the quality of the builds also made them cheap. and they basically flooded the market. And so, in Melbourne, in Brisbane, parts of Sydney, et cetera. And so, a lot of those apartments just haven't performed. And even in the 2020 sort of post-COVID boom, haven't gone up. In recent times, there's really been this lack of building of more affordable apartments. Just developers can't make them stack up. And just due to the rental crisis and investors bailing out of the capital cities, because usually they've bought these poor performing apartments and finally they can sell them for a little bit more than they paid, 10 years ago. Really, that's really put a bit of a pressure cooker under these. Even poor apartments have the fundamentals pushing them up, right? No new apartments getting built, lack of choice to rent, lack of choice to buy. And, I think that's going to be a bit of a danger zone. I can see a lot of first home buyers are going to get pushed out of the housing markets just due to the buffers and their budgets, not just in Sydney. And I think you just got to be really careful that you don't then just jump into the apartment market, particularly apartments that were built sort of 5-10 years ago, rather than the old sort of smaller red bricks, the Art Deco apartments. I think you're much better protected. They're bigger, they're in more sort of desirable locations often, and quieter pockets, and suit families rather than the high density stuff. So I think that's what I can already see. I can already see a bit of news, and you just think, like, it's just not a great asset. I know that, and the reason it hasn't gone up for 5-10 years isn't because it's just not, it was this hidden gem that no one knew about. It's just that no one really wants it, right? Like, the reality is, if it's people are only going there now because of, the desperation of being forced there. But if, prices go up, which that's likely to happen, at some point, the feasibility for developers will start to make sense. And I think the next wave of apartments won't be the same quality as what they've built for the last, 10, 15 years. You can already see the design elements to it, the materials they're using, the sustainability, the ways they're thinking about, comfort and living in the communities. They've kind of improved, like, dramatically. It's like a like all technology, I think apartments have improved a lot. From a banking point of view, I mean, it sometimes can take longer. Like, the reality is it goes through a different assessment queue. So you've got to be careful with that. And particularly if a lot of brokers are lodging it with a certain bank. And so that's something we're going to have to really manage. Hasn't been too much of an issue prior to this change. Banks haven't been crazy, crazy busy. There's not really a refinance war at the moment. So the banks aren't busy because of that. Like, a couple of years ago, there's all these cashbacks and all the banks were competing over new loans, and they're basically buying, market share, which was a bit of irony because they were just losing customers out the door just as fast. And they're basically just eating all their profits. So, and there's not many upgraders in the market. So, they have come back, and we're not part of the conversation today, but we've probably seen it more in the last 3 months than we have for the last 2-3 years, which makes sense. There's more confidence around where rates are going. There's still pent up demand. People are in houses or apartments that are too small or not really their forever homes. And there's a certain segment of the market that's always doing quite well financially, who want to get into a house that's going to give them a lot of lifestyle benefit. And while they may not have wanted to do that when rates were 6+%, if they're confident the rates are going to be, sub 5, and they think they can make that jump, a lot of upgraders are starting to think about that. I wouldn't say it's nothing like, 2020 or 2021, but it has started more. There are investors in the market, so I think that's the other thing for first home buyers to be really, I think it's going to be, quite interesting at auctions. You're going to have, mum, dad, or dad and dad and child, or mum and mum and child, or whatever the family dynamics is. But you're going to have them and, their kid, or maybe their kid, they're a bit older now. Maybe they've even got their own kids there. And then you're going to have this investor on the other side competing with the first home buyer. So the investor is going to basically be buying the momentum of the market. The first home buyer is going to be highly emotionally charged, buying with a 95% deposit, very limited in terms of a price. And I think that's going to be a trend that we will see, is the investors basically buying the properties the first home buyers want. And then a lot of, like you said, that the people will benefit from this are probably the investors who, you know, who really just want to cash in, you know, take advantage of this, you know, take money off the table. They're getting closer to retirement. You know, do they pay off their mortgage? Do they put some money into super? And so, yeah. And so I do think we're that market dynamic is going to shift.
Yeah, I think you're right. And that competition is already, we're seeing it. So if you look at the latest statistics, you can see that, in fact, the growth in the investor lending was stronger than for owner occupation over the last little while, which I think is quite, you know, an important observation. Just coming back to the
I mentioned around your, sorry, Mark, I didn't actually even answer your question before. It's, I probably was too busy thinking about the market. I mean, the bank stuff's always, to me, it's just like the ticket to the game, right? Like it's,
but it is important for people who are trying to understand the process, right? Because these processes are a little bit complex. And so, you know, I just want to spend a little bit of time on the underwriting process and things like, is the interest rate going to be the same as a non, you know, government-backed scheme? And of course,
the rates are good. Yeah, the rates are good because the banks looking at it and going, well, it's like an 80% risk loan to us because the 15% is backed by the government. I mean, that would be a bit of an issue, right? So if you're paying an extra half or 1% on your, you know, 95, well, you're basically just paying LMI, but you're paying it on an interest rate rather than a one-off cost. It's what a lot of these, you know, low deposit private lenders have sort of tried this model as well. You know, to compete with the big LMI providers like, you know, Helier, et cetera. There's been an explosion of new entrants into the first home buyer space. They, a lot of people come from a tech background and they've been frustrated that you need such a big deposit to enter the market, or they come from an investment banking background. They all of a sudden come up with this product and they have a great idea on how they're going to structure it and get it through. And then all of a sudden, and then he goes, well, how do I actually get the loan? I still need to get a loan from a bank. And a bank says, well, I'm not interested in this. I've got enough going on than trying to support this new innovative lending product. There have been those things going around. Some non-banks have offered, you know, very low deposit home loans, particularly on high incomes. But there's usually a cost to do so. It might not be LMI, it might be a higher interest rate, it might be, you know, and there's been these home equity schemes that have been coming out. So, but this 5% deposit scheme, really, you're getting yourself a good rate. You're getting it through one of the big lenders. It's not like you're going to get stuck on some major loyalty tax or anything like that. So you can be quite safe and secure knowing that, you know, it's backed by, you know, a safe option, right? And so you're not just going to get scared with this big increase in interest rates in a couple of years' time. And so I think that would be a big concern because the LMI, for example, just to give you listeners a bit of an idea how much you're saving. So if you borrow at 90%, it's roughly 2%. If you borrow at 95%, it's probably, you know, 3% to 4%. So often a lot of buyers really can't buy without a sort of 97% or 8% deposit. So like a loan around 92, 93%. So that's a big saving. Like it's the money, you know, LMI is kind of, you know, if it's investment property, it's deductible over a five-year period because it's like a borrowing cost. But if it's a home, like it's just dead money. And so, you know, on top of stamp duty, on top of legals, you know, it's a big saving for first-home buyers having to avoid that.
Yeah, well, I've for a long time argued that the LMI deal was a very bad deal for the property purchaser and a very good deal for the bank. So I have nothing but criticism for the LMI process, which is, you know, an interesting observation. The other point I sort of want to highlight is that there's the question of the interest rate, but also the duration of the loan. And one of the things that we're seeing in a lot of the conversations we're having with people is they want to sort of take the loan as for a longer duration as possible, and, you know, 30, 35 or even more. What's your thought on that? And you know, is that another lever that people should be thinking about when they're coming into this? So a 5% deposit gives you some access to the market. If you go out 35 years or something, you know, as long as you can, is that a good thing? Or do you think that's a mistaken strategy, bearing in mind, of course, that the longer the loan is with the bank, the more interest you pay?
I'm not sure if any lenders are doing it more than 30 years for this government scheme. I have to ask Jack and my team, who's our first home buyer specialist. I mean, I've been saying it for a long time that banks are going to start coming up with innovation, and to basically figure out a way to lend people more money, right? Like that's just what banks do. That's their model, right? How can I, increase credit growth? Particularly with all the challenges they've had with around ham and living expenses, all the way back to the Wagyu case at Westpac, and since then the multiple of incomes and their how much they're getting watched in terms of they assess loans are much tighter. And so that's a really tight, strong lending scheme, but that's not really what the banks want as well, right? They want to, they want to take risk. They a super safe lending system, is also means their money on the table that they could potentially make if they sort of even if some people did fall in. So that's what a bank wants to do, right? So a bank wants to bend the rules. Now what we've sort of seen is there's a lot of pressure they're putting on APRA to reduce the serviceability buffer. And Shayne Elliott, who, ex-CEO of ANZ, was very vocal. We've seen all the other big four banks, maybe not CBA, have sort of come out and supported that. And so that's been a bit of pressure. But we haven't really heard too much from APRA. But what I've also seen is that, they've sort of looked at HECS and said, look, for a lot of first-time buyers, if you include HECS into the way they borrow money, just due to the percentage of income and how it ramps up, how much you pay off HECS as your income goes up, it can really smash someone's serviceability if they've got a HECS debt. Some clients can afford to pay it off because, paying a 30 grand HECS debt off might increase their borrowing capacity, four or five times that. And so it might make sense, if they've got the cash, pay the HECS off. And interest rates on HECS debts have gone up a lot. But, CBA basically said, and I think Westpac or NAB have followed that quite recently, if that's going to get paid off in the next 5 years, we won't include it, or and so there's all this innovation happening around HECS that's interesting for first-time buyers. I think APRA could even come out and say, look, you can use a lower assessment rate on first-time buyers, but the broader market, maybe not, I think there's, because I do think it'll just put a rocket under prices, like back in 2019 when they did that. But longer loans are here. Like, I was sort of said, it's not going to be long till we see 40-year loans. I just could see it coming. The reason for that is banks basically want to increase how much you can borrow, and extending a loan term basically reduces someone's repayments, and that means that from a serviceability point of view, that they can borrow more money. And so it's all just a way of increasing the borrowing capacity of borrowers. Now, just because you can take a 40-year loan doesn't mean you pay it off over 40 years. I think this is a common misconception. This is whether, and yes, most people potentially would pay the minimum repayment on their home loan and just pay it off on the bank's term, but you don't have to be, you don't have to do that, right? So what, by paying it off, having a 40-year loan, let's say that reduces your repayment from $6,000 a month to $5,000 a month. That's just versus a 30-year loan. That's probably not that, but let's just say that. Well, that extra $1,000 a month, it doesn't mean you just go and spend it. You could still pay it off at $6,000 a month and pay it off in 30 years, or pay $7,000 a month and pay it off in 25 years, or you can pay it off on your terms. But if something goes wrong and you need to pay your mortgage next month, what would you prefer? A minimum repayment of $5,000, $6,000, or $7,000? Like, you would prefer a lower repayment because it gives you more of a buffer. And so this is where I think, and interest is exactly the same, because no matter what your loan term is, your interest is based on your loan balance. I think longer loans are here. I actually think interest-only loans are going to make a massive comeback. I think we, ultimately the LVR in our property system, what is it, 2 trillion on 11 trillion, or is it 2.5 on nearly 12 trillion? Like, it's very low. And I think because of that, and because of the tight lending, I think there's going to be an argument for banks to start to really offer longer term interest only loans again. I just think it's part of the innovation. They're going to go back to their old tricks. They haven't got many. And we've already seen that. We've already seen banks like AMP really promote a 10-year interest only. And so this is the next sort of innovation that we're going to start to see.
Yeah, it'd be interesting to see. And I guess the other question that sort of flows into my mind at this point is, interest rates are expected probably to come down a little bit more. How much more is, of course, the debate. But would people be wise to think about fixing their mortgage at this stage if they're, first-time buyer getting into the market, done their sums, want security? Or is it better to actually leave the aperture open to potentially see interest rates falling and therefore receiving perhaps a little bit of benefit from that later? What's your thinking there when you're dealing with these first-time buyers?
Look, if you are going to fix, you probably wouldn't want to go and fix, longer term, like 3, 4, 5 years. You just don't. It's hard. It's a bet that could either go well or backfire on you. And I think you just don't really want to get stuck in the world where you've got a high interest rate locked in and rates really collapse on you. Now, it'll be a lot of people that say they won't, they won't, they won't, but a lot of people didn't think COVID was going to happen. There's been other times when rates have dropped faster than people expect. And so, you've got to be careful, fixing. There's certain times when fixing is just such a good bet. But that's a rarity. Like, if I think back all over the years, it was always a bit of a trade-off, pros and cons of, is this going to work out or not? But when, COVID was here and, sub 2% 5-year fixed rates were here, you had to argue that was a good bet. And we actually went through our whole book. We had clients rolling off, not even that long ago. They were still rolling off their 4 and 5 year fix. We were basically calling our whole book and just, spending the time. And there's particularly a NAB deal that was quite late. It was 1.99 or 1.89, 1.89 for 5 years. I think it was 1.99 for 4 years. And we could start to see banks start to lift the fixed rates, and we were just like, "Look, do you want to lock in on this? Do you want to lock on this?" And so that was a time where, and a lot of those clients got really protected over that last few years. I think it was one of those things that was misunderstood in the rate increases, that a lot of the people that leveraged up really hard in 21 slash even 22 got access to 4 year fixed rates and 5 year fixed rates at sub 2%. And so, yeah, their rates went up, but they were fixing 80-90% of their loans. And so they didn't really get hit. They've been hit in the last 6 to 12 months, but 1 year of higher rates, not 3 or 4 years. And yes, there's absolutely, I'm in that camp personally, actually, that probably should have fixed. When I upgraded in 2022, and I got stung with the higher rates. But there was a lot of people that really, the ones who leveraged up the hardest, actually also locked in the biggest debt on low rates. So yeah, I would be a bit hesitant to do it at the moment. I mean, the gap, the fixed rates versus the variable rates is, yes, it's lower, but it's not at a, much, much lower. So it's not like, all you're going to need is one or two more rate cuts and you're already around the fixed rate. And then potentially if there's one or two more over that 2 or 3 years, you're starting to be out of the money. But sometimes people's cash flow is so tight that they just really want to know what that repayment is. And maybe that peace of mind of saying, yeah, I know it's $5,000 a month for the next 2 years. I don't have to think about interest rates. I just need to make sure I've got $5,000 a month for the next 2 years. And that certainty, is sometimes worth potential gamble on interest.
Well, certainly what I find when I talk to people in my one-on-ones is that when they've bought a property, they forget the extra additional costs, the rates and electricity and everything else and everything else and everything else. So when you're buying a property, it isn't just the mortgage repayment, right? It's the other things you're committing to. And one of the things I always say to people is make sure that you've actually built some sort of cash flow in your mind or on a piece of paper or a spreadsheet or an app, so you actually can know what this is going to look like once you've committed, because it isn't just the mortgage. It is actually a whole different mode of living that you've got to take account of in your budget balancing. And that might actually then determine more or less your willingness to say, yes, I'm going to commit, or I'm not going to commit, or I'm going to go variable, or I'm going to go fix, or maybe I can't afford that. I need to sort of come down a bit in price because of these other costs. So I do think it's really important. And Chris, I don't know whether that's something that you get involved in when you actually, are talking with people, whether they've done their sums or whether they haven't done their sums. But something that I see quite often is they really haven't thought it through.
Oh, we absolutely give them the I don't know, like I think first time buyers are actually quite switched on. You know, like there's you know, it's a big decision for them. You know, like I'm yes, there's people who are maybe spending more time on Instagram figuring out, you know, their outfit for the weekend or whatever it might be. You know, or looking at the latest iPhone camera versus the 16, you know what I mean? There is absolutely those people, and then they go and buy property. But I just don't, you know, a lot of people is, you know, it's huge for them, you know, and that they are, you know, and a lot of people have rented and they've lived in share accommodations or they've signed leases before, or their parents have been educating them on money and sort of bored. And so yeah, I think it's such a big thing for them, and they're very heavily invested and they want to make it right, and they've got so much anxiety about it. And so, you know, they ask more questions than any other part of the market. And you know, and they want to know what their repayments are. They want to know what all the fees are. They sort of want to get on top of it. They want to be informed. And you know, you've seen like the explosion in finfluencers for young Australians. You've got not say my podcast, but the Australian Finance podcast. You know, hundreds of thousands listen to that. She's on the Money. You know, My Millennial Money. You know, Equity Mates. Like, there's just a plethora of, you know, content, and someone's listening to it, and educating themselves and taking ownership. And I think that's what I give first-time buyers a bit more credit. I think they really do, you know, do care and want to make it happen. And yeah, maybe they probably should have. This the big issue is when big costs come up, like, you know, the rates going up from 700 a quarter to 1,000 a quarter. Like, yeah, oh, it's scary, but they'll probably find a way, you know, less Uber Eats. But it's when there's a special levy on their apartment and it's like $40,000 because there's concrete cancer in the building, or the lift needs to get done, or these are the things, you know, or there's just they just bought a dud asset. You know, the roof needs to be done. They didn't do a building and pest on it. And, you know, so I think it's these are the things that really catch them out. And I think that's where first time buyers really rush it, because they're so focused on just getting the finance, and you've got a certain type of first home buyer that's quite trigger happy. And what we find is they're emotional creatures. I'm one myself, so I'm nothing against them. But they'll get approved and they'll buy on the first weekend. And they're the ones we really try to slow down. And I'll do a special call with them often. Particularly if the client, the team see they're buying something that's, you know, what we don't believe is a great asset, I'll jump straight on and just try to give them that knowledge, because yeah, they're the ones that, you know, they'll fall in love with every property and they'll make any property work, because they're sort of like doers and they just want to tick the box and get on with it. They're less emotionally about making sure they buy at the right place. And yeah, that's a good trait, but it's also a challenging trait when you're buying property, because you really are trying to find a bit of a needle in the haystack, you know, and saying no to most and then going hard on one is the only really way to go about it.
Yeah, and just on the pre-approval process, I think it's just worth unpacking that a little bit more, right? Because effectively, you can go to the bank with your details to get an indication of what they're likely to be able to offer you without having a specific property in mind. But the gap between that and actually going through the process of actually getting that property and getting the final approval, there's a little bit of trickiness in there too, isn't there?
Yeah, get yourself pre-approved. Like, you have to get pre-approved before you sign a contract. I sort of highlighted that earlier in this. That we have seen some real miscommunication around this, and we're a little bit unsure, because it's really hard to get this stuff from, you know, the sort of through the government. Sort of, I think there's only 1 hour you can call them and the banks, and I'm just not sure how they're going to handle this. My advice, though, you know, there's 20 odd thousand brokers. You know, we would be more than happy to help anyone, but is just get your figures done, figure out who's, you know, your capacity, where you're buying, who, and get yourself pre-approved as soon as you can. And given it's the 25th of September, we're already sort of, you know, it's really only 4 or 5 days away. Yeah, just don't go looking at properties and signing contracts and go, oh, the finance will be right. I just don't think it's a good bet. And you know, the last thing you'd want to do is sign a contract and then not be able to get the finance right, and lose your deposit.
Absolutely. And of course, the point there is that the pre-approval is effectively a theoretical deal, but then you've still got to go through the practical step of finding a property and then going through the the actual mechanics in that context. And sometimes the bank will change for some reason. Maybe it's the area, maybe it's the type of property or something else. So again, you've got to be a little bit careful because pre-approval doesn't mean an automatic granting of a mortgage at that same level, does it?
Look, they should be pretty good. Like, you should be pretty safe to knowing that the amount that you're pre-approved for, a bank will honor. There are issues sometimes with valuation. There are issues if your situation changes, or if it's, getting close to expiry of your pre-approval, then, then you buy around that expiry and then it's not. So yeah, if you get a pre-approval, it's fully assessed from the bank. It's not just a, a pre-approval that's done sort of digitally online. It's and you've got your place in the scheme, then just I think you should be fine. But that's the power of a good broker is that they can give you that confidence to know that it's something you can rely on. We've had many clients over the years come with us thinking they're pre-approved. The banks are pretty bad at this, if I'm honest. I'm not throwing one under the bus, but what happens is that people will walk in off the street, go to a teller. The teller will be trained to say, "Hey, you've got a bit of money in your savings account. Are you thinking about buying a property?" They'll push them over to a personal banker slash home loan expert, and then they'll say, "Oh, tell me a bit more about your income." And you go, "Oh, look, I'm on 80,000," and okay, cool, you can borrow 500, and I'll send you an email. And that's nowhere near pre-approval. There's no credit check, there's no checking your payslips, there's and sometimes people act on that because they just haven't been informed. So yeah, I think that's where that's some real issues. And also, or they go through digital lenders and they put something and yeah, credit check's been run and and but the loan documents that what you put into the system hasn't been checked. And so if you made a mistake, which is very, very easy to do, you put your income down as a bonus rather than commission, or you put in your gross salary versus, you put your net, your gross versus your net, or whatever it might be. Yeah, you can very easily, or it might be an 85% loan versus you thought it'd be an 80% loan, and then your interest rate went up, and then your borrowing capacity fell. And, there's easy lots of mistakes you can make. So, that's the power of a good broker.
Absolutely. And I do recommend people going through that process carefully and understanding the difference between indicative, pre-approved, and a deal that's actually around a particular property because they're not the same. And
Yeah.
it's a journey. It's a very important journey. Well, Chris, we're coming towards the end of the show. Your last thoughts then, your critical piece of advice to any prospective first-time buyers excited by the scheme, thinking they want to engage with it, what are the steps that they should actually think about taking in what sequence, and what is the biggest bear trap they need to be aware of?
All right, so you're a first-time buyer, you're considering entering, let's call it. You haven't already sort of made that decision. It's really firstly, like, are you in a relationship? If you're in a relationship, how serious is it? If it's someone you're likely to stay with, do you have the hard conversation? Do you put finances on the table? You put your life planning on the table? A lot of people are scared of doing these things, but yeah, if it is serious and you're looking to stay together, or you've been together for a bit and you're planning, then you really should consider this. That would be my advice, is that because if you can prioritize that and think through your life plan, and even and go, look, yeah, okay, we're loving living in this pocket right now, but we probably wouldn't want to live there forever. And yeah, it works right now, and we've got cheap rent, and we're flat sharing with a mate or whatever it might be. But there's always going to come a time when you move on. And should you potentially bring that forward a little bit and say, right, yeah, okay, what have you got? I've got this. If I had this, or I sold the car, or we sold a few other things that we got, or maybe family would help out with 10 grand or whatever it might be. Like, do the numbers. And you might find that you're actually not that far away from a deposit. And Then you might want to just start saying, look, I know that it might be a lifestyle compromise. Yes, I would love to just keep living here. And yeah, I love just seeing my friends on the weekend and walk, you know, but like it might just be that you have to take that lifestyle compromise. It doesn't mean, you know, because what you're trying to do is take advantage of something that could work for you financially to really, you know, set you up. And so I think that would be the first thing is if you are in a position where potentially you could make it happen, but is firstly having those deep, you know, conversations. And then probably just being really, you know, thoughtful around sort of trying to, like you said, Martin, you made a really good point around time frames. Like, can you buy something not just for you now, but you know, what will suit you longer term? And then just not rushing the purchase, like really educating super quick on making sure you understand the process around protecting yourself from buying poor assets, not just from a type of property, but then the quality of the build, and so you don't get surprised with any major levies. And you know, like even if it doesn't sort of be where you want to live long term, look, if you buy quite well and you buy into a market with, you know, falling interest rates and, you know, a lot of first home buyer demand, and you know, it doesn't mean that you can't move out of there. You know, you'd want to plan for longer, but you know, if you do, particularly if you're not paying stamp duty, really your transaction cost might only be 3%. So, you know, like as soon as the property starts going up more than 3-4%, you're probably in the clear. And you know, the benefit of a highly leveraged loan that if it does go well, right, like you are leveraging your money much better than if you just save that money in the bank versus, you know, even putting it into the share market. You know what? If you say, let's do a round number because it's easier, right? Like you buy a property. We'll do 500,000, right? And you go, a 500,000 goes to 500, and we'll say it goes to 600,000, a 20% growth, which, and then you take off 3% of that for, you know, sale costs. Well, let's say you walked away with 80 grand. Let's even say 75 because you had to fix the fence or something. And for, so you made 75 profit, tax free because it was your home, and you put in 25. Well, your 25's now turned to 100. So you've made a what a 300% growth tax-free on a 20% growth in the market. That's very broad, that's very, you know, quick numbers, but it, you don't need a lot of return for it to be work out financially for you, just due to the amount of leverage you've got. But that's also you know, trying to protect yourself from the risks. It's, a lot of first time buyers are trying to build wealth, right? You're trying to build your money, and you know, and that's one of the other reasons why, you know, property can be a good option, particularly because it's growing tax-free. And if there's no transaction costs, you have to versus other options like saving or putting money into shares.
Absolutely. And just a reminder, of course, prices have tended to go higher. And, you know, my expectation is we're probably going to see some growth in prices, but not all prices are actually rising. In fact, the most recent reports I saw suggested, for example, Melbourne apartments are actually falling still in some areas at the moment. So, you know, you've got to make sure that you actually do the due diligence, you actually know the local area, you've actually got some information about, you know, what is likely to happen. And then also think about what happens if, you know, you've got these two incomes required, what happens if one of those incomes dries up for any reason? How do you deal with that? Or what happens if, for example, prices were to fall? So those are the things to think about. Run the counterfactuals too, not because you're trying to be doom and gloom, but because you want to make sure that you've actually done enough thinking and sort of analyzing of what could happen to be able to actually make the best possible decision that you can make, but also take advantage if you can, because you know the government is hanging this out for you as a first-time buyer prospectively to do that, despite the fact, of course, that the risk is then on the taxpayer and the government if prices fall, firstly. And then secondly, of course, we, the taxpayer, are helping to make it happen. So, you know, you should thank the taxpayer as well, I guess.
Yeah, you are right, and I think that the only thing I would say is that is the first home buyer that sometimes you can go through analysis paralysis. You can overthink things. You can over be concerned about things going wrong, and you know, you can potentially get yourself stuck in a negative feedback loop of you know, doomsday on what's going to happen. And unfortunately, there's potentially a cost if you get it wrong. And so while you definitely want to be aware of risks and be aware of, you know, dangers in markets, you also just got to be careful you don't get yourself stuck in a fear of making a decision. And a lot of first-time buyers do have that issue because of maybe the way they grew up, maybe the news articles they read, maybe where they work. You know, there's certain things that the bad stories they may have heard from family or friends, and they get stuck in this fear of making a mistake, and they end up just going for the easy option, which is not making a decision. And unfortunately, that can be really costly for first-time buyers, is the inaction. And so, prepare for it, you know, if you lost your job. But you also, like, you know, realistically, how long would you be out of work? You know, how likely would you get another job? Like, you know, what else could you do if that happened? And so don't get yourself stuck in this, you know. And, yeah, absolutely, you know, you can buy poor properties and some properties go down, but you can also just avoid those. If you mentioned Melbourne there and apartments, yeah, absolutely. Just don't go anywhere near high density apartments in Melbourne. And be very careful in even small boutique blocks. You know, I for years haven't been buying into the, some buyer's agents have been sort of still perpetuating that. I think that, you know, why would you buy an apartment in Melbourne when you could have bought a house? But if you bought a, you've seen Melbourne over the next couple of years in the houses sub 1 million, I think you'll find that they go up. And I think that's, you know, a same city, but just a different part of the market.
And which is the point, isn't it? It's about having a mature piece of thinking about the type of property, et cetera, et cetera. Doing the work around the finance, doing work, of course, also about, you know, making sure that the pieces come together and control the process. But it is an opportunity. And so, Chris, I really appreciate the opportunity to discuss this with you. And to hopefully we've, you know, laid a few thoughts for people to make sure that they can actually take advantage of this and not get caught up into a negative doom loop or anything else. If they want to find out more about you and what you do, where should they go?
Alcove.com.au. Absolutely reach out. You'd most likely speak to, if you're a first time buyer, maybe Jack in our team. He's kind of, you know, helping a lot of our first time buyers, but it's also Ali and Sandy would be our first call. But we've also got a big broader strategy team and myself as well who lead that, our clients. And so, yeah, you're in safe hands with all of our team here.
Terrific. Well, Chris, thank you very much for your time. Really appreciate it. And I shall watch with interest over the next few or 3 months as this all plays out. I think it's going to be an interesting time.
Yeah, absolutely. Let's chat at the end of the year or early next. And just see. I do think it's going to be quite messy, if I'm honest, you know, particularly on the finance side. I think it's going to be a bit for the banks to manage. And then also, and there's going to be some, you know, where it goes wrong as well. And so we're going to have to scramble to help clients that, you know, maybe have not got pre-approved at other brokers. And yeah, it's all going to be, but and it's just such a short time frame. Like, it's really October and November, and the market will dry up pretty quickly in December. And so, I think a lot will happen over the next few months.
Absolutely. Well, that's why I wanted to have these conversations now, to alert people and to help, to hopefully help them. Chris, thank you very much. I'll take you offline and I'm going to close the show now. Thank you very much for your time this evening. And I'll look forward to catching up again soon. Take care.
Thank you, Mark. Cheers.
Cheers. So there you are. I hope you found that informative and interesting. I think Chris always has a really interesting and, you know, perceptive view of what's going on, particularly from the mortgage broker point of view. Just to remind you that next Tuesday, we'll be picking up this conversation again with B Wright, and Aaron will be having a discussion there about his perspective. He put out some interesting material too, and we want to talk about some of the other risks that people might want to think about. And I suspect, going back to that picture, could it have something to do with going underwater? I don't know. We shall have to find out next Tuesday. So check that out. And just to say, the doggies are here. Well, one dog is, Luna's here, Mitya's around the corner. So they've been listening to what we've been saying too. Anyway, thank you very much for spending some time with us on this Thursday evening. Have a good few days. I'll look forward to seeing you next Tuesday, and check out the recorded shows on the other days. Meantime, this is Martin North from Digital Finance Analytics signing off. Take care. Bye.